I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. 4 years ago, the world was watching the Arab Spring unfold as demonstrators in the Middle East took to the streets to protest the repressive governments of their countries. Today, the world watches as ISIS, or the self-proclaimed Islamic State, continues its fight to create a caliphate, controlling wide swaths of Iraq and Syria and terrorizing much of the population. Our guest Shadi Hamid was director of research at the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar until January 2014. He's now a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, wrote a book last year called Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East, and he joins us on Radio Times. Shadi Hamid, nice to have you with us on the show.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Is there a connection between the failure of the Arab Spring and the rise of ISIS from your perspective?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, as someone who was in Tahrir Square 4 years ago, I was there when Mubarak fell. And just to see the euphoria, Egyptians just so happy that finally they've kind of taken control of their own destinies. And one thing that I've tried to really look at and understand is how did we go from this high point of optimism to where we are now? And part of it is I think that there was hope that the democratic process would be an option for people, that yes, there are deep foundational divides in the Middle East over the role of religion, for example, but that people would agree to resolve those differences and respect democratic outcomes, participate in elections. But what we found out instead is that violence works sometimes and more often than not in the Middle East. And whether it's autocratic regimes that kind of bounce back and repress their own people, or groups like ISIS and other militants that said, we don't have time for the democratic process and all this nonsense. We're going to impose our vision through brute force. And I just worry that one of the lessons people have taken away from the Arab Spring is that violence is an effective option for them, because democracy in most of these countries, so whether it's Yemen, Syria, Egypt, we've seen the rise of civil conflict, authoritarian regimes, and so on.
Well, picking up on what you just said, and you wrote something in The Atlantic last year, you write, we might not admit it or not, but violence in Cannes often does work in today's Middle East. I circled that because you seem to be saying perhaps democracy doesn't work in the Middle East. Can we draw that conclusion?
Democracy hasn't worked in the Middle East so far. I think that it can. I think it's something that the international community should support. But democracy is going to look a little bit different than what we as Americans may be comfortable with. And I think we have a tendency to look at democracy and liberalism as two sides of the same coin because of our own history. But what we actually find out, and this is something that I argue in the book, is that more democracy in the Middle East might empower illiberal and religiously conservative groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, like in Nahda in Tunisia, and that's what we saw in several of these countries. So that means more it raises this question, what happens when democracy leads to outcomes that we as Americans are uncomfortable with, and we see these religious groups that maybe want Islamic law to play a more prominent role. They have not very liberal views on gender rights and things like that. But I think that we have to respect that other societies, including in the Middle East, might want to chart their own course when it comes to the role of religion. And I think there has to be some respect for the different role that religion sometimes plays in Muslim-majority societies.
Is it the sort of guiding principle of these societies, the role of religion? And it's not like religion doesn't play a role in this country.
Yes, certainly, certainly. But it's not just that people want religion in a kind of vague sense to play a role. But, you know, if we look at a lot of the polling in some of the more conservative countries in the Middle East, you know, large majorities want Islamic law.
Sharia law.
Sharia law. Now, people can disagree about what Sharia law means. And I think sometimes in the U.S., we automatically assume that Sharia law equals crazy fundamentalist things. That's not really how it works in practice. So each Muslim will have a different view on what Sharia means to them. But the general thrust is a lot of people want Islam to be central to one degree or another. So when we come and say, well, you know, you should think about an Islamic reformation or privatizing religion or keeping it separate, that doesn't necessarily resonate in those societies. But, you know, part of what democracy is, in my view, it's about the right to make the wrong choice. Even if you disagree with someone's choice, you should respect it. And you can try to nudge them or encourage them to move in a different direction. But it's up to Egyptians and Jordanians and Tunisians to make their own choices.
Well, we think of liberal democracy, you know, as protecting the rights of the individual. We think of the free and fair elections, certainly separation of church and state, the rule of law, equal protections, human rights, civil rights, things like that. You're saying given a choice, people in some of these Muslim countries or Arab countries would not necessarily choose something like that.
Yeah. So, for example, when it comes to things like how far should freedom of speech go? Should you be allowed to criticize the Prophet or denigrate the Quran? So when it comes to things like blasphemy, there would be differences there. On gender equality, there are different gender norms in the Middle East. And again, if we look at polling, you know, there still is a long way when it comes to accepting, you know, equality for both sexes. Minority rights, things that are – that might actually seem kind of minor but are actually lightning rods in these societies, banning alcohol. So one thing that secularists fear, that if Islamists come to power, they'll restrict things like alcohol consumption. They'll maybe promote gender segregation at different levels of schooling. They'll try to Islamize the educational curricula. So those are the types of things that we might, you know, that people talk about in practice.
Well, including another article that you wrote, perhaps the same article, looking at some of these surveys, 80% of Egyptians respondents said they favored stoning adulterers, while 70% supported cutting off the hands of thieves. So you read something like that, and it's so easy to imagine that if we think of an Islamic government, we think of the kind of extremes that we might associate with ISIS, for instance.
Yes. So polling results like that are quite striking and troubling. Now, polling is an inexact science in the Middle East. So some of those results might be overstated. And also people might say in theory, well, we should cut off the hands of thieves. But if a government actually did it, they'd be a little bit taken aback and say, well, actually, maybe we don't want that after all. So, you know, but I don't think realistically groups like the Brotherhood. So I think we have to distinguish between what I call mainstream Islamist groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and extremists like ISIS. The Brotherhood hasn't really talked about cutting off the hands of thieves and doing things like that. They're pragmatic. They know that the international community would never accept that. That there are limits to how far they can go. And I think what's different about the extremists is that they have no they don't believe in gradualism. They don't believe in working within international realities. For them, it's about imposing their vision and their vision only. And anyone who disagrees with that is kind of cast outside the fold, if you will.
So how Islamic is the Islamic State, or ISIS, or ISIL, as the president calls them?
So this is, you know, this is a conversation that, you know, I think a lot of us have been having the last few months, trying to make sense of how much religion matters here. And it's, I think it's certainly the case that ISIS fighters believe that what they're doing is God's commandment. They believe that their vision of Islam is the right one. But if we talk about the overwhelming majority of Muslims, then they disagree and don't share ISIS's ideology. And in many cases, it's other Muslims who are fighting against ISIS and trying to repel their advance. So I think we have to make those distinctions, but we shouldn't doubt that ISIS themselves, they're not doing this just for political power or because they want money. So for them, they believe that if they die in the battlefield against what they consider to be infidels, that they will have direct entry into heaven. And there's a kind of power in that, because when they're fighting against, say, the Iraqi army in a particular battle, Iraqi soldiers don't have a lot of morale. They're not necessarily willing to die for their cause, but ISIS fighters most of the time are. So that gives them a kind of built-in advantage. And it's certainly true as well that they draw on ideas in Islamic history that do have broad resonance. So, for example, the idea of a caliphate. And this is where I think ISIS have really been brilliant from a marketing standpoint, unfortunately, is that they've been able to use terms that are powerful and ideas that are powerful, because when Muslims hear the word caliphate, they think about the glory days when Muslims were strong, when they were rising, when they dominated, when they were winning wars instead of constantly losing them. So I think that this idea of a caliphate, even though most Muslims disagree with ISIS's interpretation of the caliphate, there's something there that's powerful.
How, though, reconciling this yearning for a caliphate and its mistreatment of the people that it conquers? I mean, not all of them, but enough of them to be pretty horrifying.
Well, this is where I think ISIS is alienating more and more people the longer that it governs, because it is very brutal. And brutality is central to its strategy. They want to instill fear in people's hearts so that people are afraid to fight them, for example. So I think that's why there's a limit to how much. But part of the problem here, though, is ISIS doesn't need to be popular to be successful. And I think what they've been able to do is to portray themselves as the alternative. So when you're choosing between a political vacuum where it's utter chaos and no one has security, so in large swaths of Syria and Iraq, there is no effective government. ISIS comes in, they're brutal, they impose their vision, but some Sunnis might say, well, at least they provide some degree of law and order, so we'll go with them. And I think that what makes ISIS different from other extremist groups is that it has more interest in governance. So it has actually been able to run local administrations. It has been able to hold territory and to provide social services. So that's what makes them more of a threat. Al-Qaeda never actually was serious about governing large parts of territory and having something that was this real caliphate, where ISIS is actually doing it.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here. Do you, as some say, that the people that are sort of under the thumb of ISIS will eventually rise up and say no more, or overthrow them, or drive them out of the regions that they do control?
I think that will happen eventually, and it's already happened in some parts of Iraq. But the problem is, if they're not going to rise up unless they know someone is backing them up, because ISIS are very effective fighters and very dangerous. So no one's going to want to stand up to them unless they know they have a real chance of winning. And I think this is where you hear a lot of complaints, whether it's from Iraqis or more often from Syrian rebels, who say, well, we want to fight ISIS, but the U.S. isn't giving us more military support, more financial support. So this is where the international community's role is quite important.
And I do want to pick up on that, but first a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Shadi Hamid. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. We are talking about ISIS, we're talking about Islamists, and we are also taking comments at Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Shadi Hamid about the Middle East, about Islamism, about the rise of ISIS. And again, you can send us a comment at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times with any questions or comments. You have been critical, or you were critical, of the Obama administration when there was a point a couple of years ago when the U.S. could have and in a sense was being asked to support some of these rebel groups in Syria. The U.S. decided not to do that. Was that a fatal decision from your perspective when it comes to the rise of ISIS?
I think it'll be remembered as one of the major mistakes of this administration, of leaving Syria to really disintegrate and not doing more to step in earlier on, when some of the more so-called moderate rebels had the momentum, that they were playing a large role on the ground. And I think we lost a real opportunity in 2012 and 2013. And if we want to understand the rise of ISIS, you can't understand that without looking at the role of Syria, that this is where ISIS was really able to gain momentum and strength and build support in Syria and then spill over back into Iraq. And, you know, to this very day, there's still a gaping hole in our Syria strategy that, you know, even after we knew how much of a threat ISIS was, Syrian rebel groups have been facing off against ISIS in Syria and saying, ISIS is coming in. We need American support, pleading for outside assistance, and that assistance has not been forthcoming.
Do you think that's because of the Iraq war and the Obama administration, and even the Iraq war, the Obama administration's reluctance to get involved in another conflict? I mean, we are doing bombings and it seems like drone strikes and things like that in the Middle East, U.S.
Yes. So well, part of it is this administration saw its legacy as extracting America from the entanglements of the Middle East. So, you know, in a kind of sense, I feel Obama sees the Middle East almost as a nuisance. He would rather not be involved. And when he does get involved, it's very reluctantly. He's dragged in slowly and unwillingly. And I think now there are airstrikes in Syria, but you can't just do airstrikes. Mm-hmm. You actually have to seriously support rebels on the ground, the local actors who are actually going to capture and hold territory. And that's where there still hasn't been a lot of support. So the reliance just on airstrikes is never going to be enough.
Let me ask you about one of the we did several shows on this a couple of years ago. One of the reluctance from the Obama administration seemed to be, we don't exactly know who it is that we're dealing with. And yes, we might be arming this rebel group, but they have ties to that rebel group that actually has ties to, you know, groups that we do not want to be affiliated with. The idea that there's some sort of clean, these are the good guys and these are the bad guys. And it seems that it's much more complicated than that.
Yes. And this is where the longer we've waited to get involved in Syria, the more we actually do see, as you point out, extremist groups that are playing prominent roles in much of Syria. So the longer we wait, the more difficult it becomes. But I think there's also this what I find it to be a little bit weird that we only want to support as if rebels in a war zone are going to be nice, fluffy, pro-American liberals. Yes, I mean they're not going to be exactly what we want, because in war you don't tend to have liberals on the front lines. But we can make distinctions between groups, and there is a spectrum. And we have, and I think there has been a lot of research. We do know a lot about these groups, and there are many that are anti-ISIS and anti-Assad regime. And those are the ones we don't necessarily have to actively support them, but we shouldn't block those groups. I think part of the problem up until now is that whenever we hear about a group that has this Islamist label, we immediately kind of take a step back and say, oh, Islamist, we have to kind of stay away from all of that. But not all Islamists are the same.
And when you say Islamist, I want to make sure that people understand what it is that you mean by that.
Yeah, sure. So the definition would be, you know, Islamist groups are those who want Islam and Islamic law to play a more central role in public life. So that's actually a broad definition. And within that, you have a whole spectrum of how much you want Islamic law to be central and what Islamic law means to you. Do you take a very strict literalist approach, or do you take a more pragmatic, flexible approach?
And are you suggesting that the U.S. send in then military troops of, you know, boots on the ground, as we call it?
No. This is where I do agree with the Obama administration that boots on the ground in a place like significant boots on the ground, because there already are advisors and in Iraq and elsewhere. But we don't want to repeat the mistakes of the Iraq war. But there is a middle ground, and this is where I think the debate in Washington has been very much, well, either you're a neocon and you support full-on invasion, or you don't get involved at all. There's a lot in between, and we can find the right balance between these approaches. But I think this is where I think the legacy of the Bush administration has been so destructive, because Americans look back and they say, well, we don't want to do that. And the Obama administration in particular sort of see themselves as the anti-Bush. So if Bush was doing something like that, we want to stay away from that approach completely.
There's one argument, too, which is just let them fight it out. And if this is, you know, at its sort of bottom line, a Sunni-Shia conflict that goes back centuries, this is a theory, let them fight it out and we stay on the sidelines. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I think I see that as a bit problematic because there's almost a sense there that, oh, you know, Muslims are hopeless. They're always going to be fighting each other and there's nothing anyone can do about it. But if we look at the Shia-Sunni conflict, that's gotten worse as of late. That hasn't always been the case. So we have to ask ourselves, why wasn't it as bad 10 or 15 years ago? Something changed in between. And this is where political factors matter. When you have political vacuums, when you have failures of governance, when you have failures of democracy, and we shouldn't act as innocent bystanders in this as Americans because we unfortunately haven't done a good job of supporting democracy in the Middle East. And this goes back, this isn't just post-Arab Spring. Really, for the last five decades, we have been supporting autocratic regimes and in some cases actively undermining the democratic process. And there's an unfortunate, tragic history there. So I think that we have to see our role and our responsibility in the messed upness of the Middle East, if you will.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and that's Shadi Hamid. For 4 years, he was director of research at the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar. This was until January of last year, January 2014. He's currently a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Wrote a book last year called Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East, and joins us on Radio Times to talk about the many things that are happening in the Middle East, something that I'm sure you are very well aware of. You can send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. You made an interesting comparison between the Middle East and what happened in Bosnia, and that perhaps Bosnia, not perfectly, might be a way out of trying to detangle some of these conflicts.
Yeah, so exactly. In Bosnia and Kosovo, we heard some of this same language in the early 90s, that there are ancient hatreds and that Serbs, Croats, and Muslims and Christians are never going to find a way to live together, and they're almost in a sense doomed to kill each other. And this is actually and this is one of the reasons that the U.S. was hesitant to get involved, drawing on some of these ideas. But then We kind of learned from that and we evolved, and the Clinton administration did what I think was the right decision. And Bosnia and Kosovo are better now than they were then. And, you know, part of what happened there is that Milosevic and the Serbs were forced to get on the negotiating table because of the credible threat of military force. Mm. And I think this is an important lesson for Syria and elsewhere. Military intervention isn't just about regime change. It's not as if you just go in and you destroy the regime. No, the idea is that the threat of military intervention will show people like Assad that the international community is serious, that there are in fact real red lines, not imaginary red lines, and that once he sees that there's no way he can win and that the momentum is shifting against him, he will be forced to talk and talk in good faith.
So, I mean, the key to understanding and also addressing the problems in Syria still is Assad.
You know, I think
it seems so chaotic from the outside. It's sort of hard to know who's fighting who.
Look,
sometimes
I think there's a temptation now, and you're hearing it more and more, that Assad is a necessary evil, that we have to work with him because ISIS is the greater threat. But then we're just going back to this very short-term thinking. And I think if there's one lesson of our involvement in the Middle East is that short-term thinking might work for the short term, but it comes back to haunt us. And the Assad regime and its brutality is one of the root causes of the conflict in Syria. That's the reason why the initially nonviolent protesters ultimately took up arms, because they were being shot down nonstop by the Assad regime. So there's no way to address Syria unless we address that root of the conflict. And you know, maybe, you know, now might not be the right time, but at some point we're going to have a serious discussion about targeted airstrikes against the Assad regime, because if we have so-called moderate rebels that aren't just fighting ISIS but are also fighting the Assad regime, the ones that we've trained, the 5,000 fighters that people have been talking about, what happens if they're fighting Assad? Do we just leave them to, you know, leave them to be fought and killed? So at some point, I think we have to, you know, re-enter that discussion. I know that people aren't very, you know, there isn't a lot of willingness for that. But again, I don't see how Assad can be a partner, considering his history.
But I wonder, also looking back at the Middle East, you get rid of a powerful, brutal leader or dictator, and oftentimes what you get in its place is a void. You get conflict. You get people who are unprepared, unwilling to use power in a more benign kind of way.
I think this is exactly what happened, for example, in Libya, where Gaddafi fell, Part of the problem is that we don't think about the day after. So Gaddafi fell and we said, great, this is what we want. And that was a very positive first step. But then you can't just leave the Libyans to their own devices and say, well, okay, we did our part, time to leave. And time again, we see this, whether it was Afghanistan in the 1990s, you know, Iraq, of course, where we got rid of Saddam, we said mission accomplished, and we weren't thinking about how you stabilize the day after. Now, it raises the question, are we as Americans ever going to be comfortable with the kind of, you know, I know it's sort of a bad word now, nation building or state building, but we have to build more capacity, not just the U.S., but also with our partners, to see how we can help countries rebuild after civil conflict. But that takes a real commitment.
You lived in Doha for 4 years. How does the U.S. look from that perspective? And oftentimes, again, going back to polls, which you say sometimes are unreliable, seems like there is so much anti-Americanism in this part of the world, and even so much more even under President Obama.
This is one of the—
Which is a curious thing.
Yeah, it's a bit of an irony that at least in some countries, America's approval ratings are lower under Obama than they were under Bush. And I mean, a lot of people might remember the Cairo speech of 2009, where Obama was talking about a new beginning with the Middle East. I mean, that kind of optimistic talk seems so removed from where we are now. But I think that, you know, one thing that I kept on hearing living in the region, wherever really I was traveling, this confusion about what U.S. policy actually was, that sometimes it seemed like we were supporting democracy. Sometimes it seemed like we were supporting autocrats. Sometimes it seemed like we were trying to have a grand alliance with the Iranians. Sometimes it seemed like we were moving closer to the Saudis. At the end of the day, our policy is utterly incoherent. Mm. There isn't a consistent thread or narrative that ties the different conflicts together. So it's very much this ad hoc crisis management that we wait for the fire to break out, then we try to put it out. Again, this kind of short-term thinking without really having a long-term strategic approach.
So what would be a coherent policy? What would that look like that would deal with all the complexities we've been talking about?
Well, I think one key element has to be, and in some ways it's too late now, but it should have been taking democracy and supporting good governance much more seriously. That if we look at 2011, we didn't actually commit much additional financial support to these transitional countries that were really fragile and should have been helped along: Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Libya. And if you look at the additional aid committed, it's just in the number of a few, a couple billion here and there. When if you look, for example, and I don't think it's not equivalent, but just if you look at the Marshall Plan and what we did in Western Europe in the 1940s, we're talking about over $100 billion, committed to these countries to rebuild. It doesn't have to be anything close to that, but if we saw this as a world historical moment, a chance for us to really encourage the Middle East to go in a better direction, there should have been a much more serious financial, moral commitment. There should have been, in my view, more military support and even military intervention in Syria in 2012 or 2013. I think now, in some sense, it's too late to undo all of the damage. But there is more we can do in terms of defeating ISIS. And I think, again, what we continue to see in the Middle East is a lot of U.S. half measures, that we do a little bit, we do more, but we don't do as much as we need to do. If the goal is, in fact, to defeat ISIS, I don't think our means match the ends.
Can we defeat ISIS? I mean, we weren't able to, quote unquote, defeat al-Qaeda. I mean, we got rid of Osama bin Laden, but, you know, al-Qaeda still exists. Is it a matter of defanging them somehow?
So we're never going to eradicate groups like ISIS altogether, but we can defeat them in terms of significantly weakening them and recapturing more territory that they hold. They're never going to disappear, but to really be able to recapture territory from them, you need a bigger commitment, as I said earlier, on Syria in particular. You know, we've said that we're willing to commit $500 million to train 5,000 fighters. I mean, that's really a drop in the bucket if you look at the overall theater in a place like Syria, where you have over 100,000 fighters from across the spectrum. So this makes me feel not very optimistic going forward. And I think what's so dangerous about ISIS is that they've removed the mental block of the caliphate. And this is something that we're going to be with for not years but decades to come. And by that I mean that any time you have a piece of territory that's ungoverned or ungovernable, you're going to have an extremist group that says, well, why don't we establish our own mini emirate or mini caliphate here, because ISIS has set the standard for other extremist groups. So for al-Qaeda, the caliphate was just an idea and aspiration, but ISIS has made it real, that you can capture whole territory and govern. And this is what we're seeing with groups like Boko Haram and others who want to aspire to this kind of model. So I worry that this is the wave of the future. So even if we defeat ISIS tomorrow morning, that's still going to be with us.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Shadi Hamid. He's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Wrote a book last year called Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Shadi Hamid about the Middle East, the various conflicts in the Middle East, and some of his ideas, his thoughts about how to address these conflicts and problems. An email from Neil, he says, won't ISIS eventually burn itself out on its own brutality?
So ISIS is already losing support because of its own brutality. But that's not enough, and I think what we've seen is we've kind of hit this. We've run into a bit of a stalemate. So they have been repelled in some parts of Iraq, and much of Tikrit has been recaptured by Iraqi forces. But they still hold a lot of territory, and because brutality can be a liability, but it can also be effective, in the sense that. Brutality makes them very difficult to defeat. Mm-hmm. They fight dirtier than anyone else.
That's a kind of asymmetrical.
Yeah. But I think also there has to be an alternative. So as bad and as brutal as ISIS is, who is going to take its place? Someone has to be able to come in and not just defeat them, because you can have them being defeated in certain theaters, but then there's kind of chaos and a vacuum, and then ISIS is able to step back in, and you just have this kind of endless back and forth and whack-a-mole. So there have to be parties and groups that have legitimacy on the ground that are able to hold territory for a longer period of time. And there aren't always obvious alternatives, especially in a place like Syria.
Shifting gears slightly, but I remember when the world was talking about al-Qaeda, and it always struck me that the al-Qaeda terrorists that came to this country also were known to go to strip clubs and things like that. So this notion of purity, you know, purity on paper, but purity in reality. Are there questions about how ISIS actually lives, how they actually follow the Quran, for instance, and how pure are they in actual practice?
Yeah, so there are things that we know they do and are now quite well documented that for, you know, 99% of Muslims would be outrageous. I mean, taking slaves and concubines and this sort of thing. But they find ways in their own kind of twisted manner and drawing, kind of cherry-picking from historical sources and aspects of Islamic law and taking them out of context and saying, we have found the right way and we have license. So they find ways to justify even their most terrifying acts. Mm. But if we look at the people who actually join ISIS, and it's an interesting question, why do – you know, not just poor. I mean, sometimes we think that, oh, poverty and terrorism go together. But we have our fighters from middle class families in European countries, and they were somewhat well integrated. But what I think we have a real, you know, there's young people in parts of Europe, in parts of the Middle East, feel alienated. And feel that they have to choose, for example, between their French identity and their Muslim identity. So that they go through this period of confusion and they're impressionable and they're susceptible to this kind of idea. They want to die for a cause that's bigger than themselves. So where other people might choose to join gangs or take drugs or join a leftist radical group, because they're Muslim and they might be more Islamically oriented, they see ISIS and they fall prey to this idea that ISIS is this kind of utopia of going back to the time of the Prophet. Now, when they actually do go to Syria and Iraq, oftentimes they'll find that it's not quite what they expected. And we have more and more cases of disillusioned fighters who either find a way to leave or try to leave and are executed. But I think that ISIS kind of feeds into this adolescent fantasy of what a utopian Islamic state might look like.
There's a woman actually in the Philadelphia area that allegedly was interested in joining ISIS. And it's, to me, it's just fascinating and unnerving to think of women joining this organization, knowing how they view women and treat women.
Yes, that is quite incredible. But it seems that in these cases, you know, women are making the choice they're not being forced into it. And it really is it is tough to get. I have trouble getting my head around that.
Is ISIS a death cult?
So I wouldn't quite put it that way, in the sense that they're not just interested in dying. They're interested in a real-life caliphate. They are interested in the more mundane aspects of governance. I mean, they do things that other states do, like collecting taxes, like coming up with educational curricula. So it's interesting to see an organization where the mundane practicalities of politics kind of clash with the other side of ISIS, this kind of darker, apocalyptic, reckless side of them. And this is where I think the tensions are irreconcilable, because they're torn in these two different directions. And this is where I think they are having real challenges. Because they do, for example, they do believe very much in the apocalypse. And this is where end of times imagery really feeds into ISIS's narrative. So they do think about death quite a lot, but they do also think about life in the sense of how to actually govern their piece of territory.
A comment from Richard says, we seem totally oblivious to the fact that we're being manipulated by ISIS and taking the bait. Does that make sense to you at all? The idea, I guess, that ISIS wants to fight America and wants to pull us into the conflict.
Yeah, this is always a challenge with extremist and terrorist groups, that sometimes they want to drag us into their conflicts. And part of what terrorism is about is provoking the target country to do things they otherwise wouldn't do. So we have to be very careful. Yes, we have to be careful about knowing how far to go. So I personally, you know, I believe that we should be militarily involved in Iraq and Syria, that ISIS, we do need to fight ISIS because of the nature of the threat that they pose to the U.S. and its allies, to Middle East stability. But we have to be careful to not go overboard and feed into their narrative. So it has to be done delicately. And that's where, for example, I don't think it would be very effective to have boots on the ground.
But you see ISIS as a threat to the United States.
I wouldn't overstate the threat that they pose to the homeland, where – and this is where ISIS is a little bit different than al-Qaeda, that they're more focused on the so-called near enemy more than the far enemy. That said, ISIS leaders have made calls to their supporters in Western countries saying that, you know, if you have the opportunity, kill the infidels wherever you might find them. But it's not centralized or directed. But this is where I think the bigger problem is lone wolves or people who are acting out of their own volition because they're inspired by ISIS. But I think when it comes to where ISIS is committing its resources, it's much more of a threat to the Middle East. But what happens in the Middle East is very important to us. So we can't just say, well, they're focusing on the Middle East, so it's not really relevant to us.
Another actually, this is a tweet from Michelle. We touched on this earlier, but she says, any thoughts on the identity vacuum in the UK, France, et cetera, and its impact on recruitment? And it seems the U.S. does a better job of absorbing immigrants into our larger culture. Looks like France and the UK have more of a struggle with that. Do you think that creates these opportunities for ISIS?
Yeah, this is I think, one factor, one factor that contributes to a bigger problem in Europe. I think the U.S. by and large has done a better job of integrating Muslims. And I think part of it has to do with how we view the role of religion in the U.S., that someone can be fully American but also be quite conservative, whether as an evangelical Christian, an Orthodox Jew, or a very observant Muslim who covers her hair, for example. So there isn't that kind of conflict, where in France, if you do wear the headscarf, then you're not seen to be quite as French as everyone else. And there are real ideological divides in France and Britain when it comes to how Muslims and non-Muslims in these countries view the role of religion. And Europe generally is a more secular and secularized culture than the U.S. is. Right. So I think that's where we've been able to do a better job of making people feel more comfortable expressing their religion in the private and public sphere.
Let me see what looks like Bob from Kutztown has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I just was thinking that it's fine to talk about the United States' role and what it can do and can't do and so on. But one thing that he seems to be ignoring, your guest, is the context. I mean, the one reason why the United States didn't get involved so quickly is because of the wars in the past, recent past, and because of the role of Russia and Russia in line with Iran. And so there's the broader context. You can't just go and do what you want to do, even just like in terms of Russia going into Crimea. So anyway, I'd like to hear his thinking in regard to the broader prospect.
Sure, Bob. I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I don't think either you or I, certainly not you, haven't not said this, anything as simple in the Middle East. But Bob raises, I think, a good point.
Yeah, so we can't do what we want. But in the case of Syria, there was a broad coalition that was willing to support us in a military intervention. If you recall, in August 2013, where we were very close to launching airstrikes, you had many Arab countries, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, the French were quite supportive. So there was a coalition there. So no one is saying that the U.S. should go do whatever it wants alone. We know that doesn't work. We know unilateral approaches are counterproductive. And we also know that there is no good option here. So really the conversation we're having isn't between bad and good options. It's between different levels of badness and what's less bad. But and the longer we wait, the more difficult it gets to intervene. And this is where I think Obama's strategy is backfiring in a kind of interesting way. Is we are being forced to intervene now in a way we wouldn't have before if we had acted earlier. So this is the problem with reactive approaches, is that at the end of the day, you're going to be forced to have intervene anyway in a way that's more difficult, more complex, and more messy.
So this is the problem with waiting, or if you know, or dithering, if you will.
Mm. Bob, thanks for the call. Let me see what Mary from Monmouth County has to say. And Mary, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Okay, I have 2 points to make. One is that I wish that you would please consider that no matter how terrible the terrorists are, which is awful, can you consider that we terrorize awfully? We have shock and awe. We use drones. We use such military might. And so the terrorists don't have the money, and they have this. This is the option they have. That's one point. The other point is that I really feel America has taken the wrong path for so long. We're trying to control and take care of our interests, and therefore what we really should do is be investing tremendously in raising these poor people up from the destitution that some of them are in. And we should not be supporting the Saudi government. That is just because of our interest. It's not. I just really think our approach is totally wrong.
Okay, Mary, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Do you agree with her?
Well, there's a couple of things there. I mean, the U.S., there's no doubt that the U.S. has done bad things in the Middle East. But, I don't think we really can compare between a group like ISIS and
drones,
most of the
nations.
Yeah, I don't think there's any moral equivalency there, but really any moral equivalency with the vast majority of nation states in the world. I think ISIS takes, I hesitate to use I think the word evil is misused a lot, but if there's one place where I think it's appropriate to use it, it is with groups like ISIS. And we shouldn't underestimate the threat that this particular terrorist group poses. And there are other terrorist groups and other extremist groups that, you know, there are different approaches of dealing with them because it's a different kind of threat. And this is where ISIS is. I don't want to say it's singular or totally unique, but it is a distinctive kind of group. And that's why I myself take it more seriously. And I think that we have to take it more seriously. But I certainly take the point that we as Americans have a responsibility to look at our own policies and look at ways that we can be better, that we can have a more – the U.S. is not a human rights organization. So we're never going to be as moral as I think a lot of people might like us to be, but we can be better. And when it comes to our support for autocratic regimes, I think that's where we can find a better balance. Yes, we have to work with the Saudis or the Egyptians, no matter how repressive they are. But that doesn't mean that we should go out of our way to legitimize, or we should find ways to put pressure on these regimes to at least encourage them to embark on gradual reform. Or, for example, in the case of Egypt, where we use $1.3 billion of military aid to put pressure on their Egyptian regime. We do have options there that we haven't really taken.
We're almost out of time here, but do you think in 10 years' time, if we were to have this conversation again, would we be having the same conversation or a different one, do you think?
Well, it'll probably be similarly pessimistic, and I don't want to leave your listeners on a negative note, but I worry that, you know, as bad as 2014 was, 2015 in just the first 3 months has proven to be worse. So I think, you know, sometimes in the Middle East you wonder, well, can it really get worse than this?
Yeah.
But sometimes it can, and oftentimes it does.
I hate to end on that note, but I do appreciate you joining us today on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. That's Shadi Hamid, and he's a fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. Wrote a book called Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. And he's in Philadelphia. He's back. In fact, we'll be speaking in a couple of hours at Temple University. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thanks so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. Okay.